Mr. Benham, reel 3. How did you come to be injured when you were shot foot?
I was hit by a machine gun bullet through my foot on a Sunday night. We were taking over a length of trenches at a place called near Maynil, M-E-S-N-I-L, Maynil, and trenches were half full of water anyway. This was April, and very congested. And I'd gone up with the advance party, and I think I'd gone up the night before. You could only move at night, it was so dangerous there. We were very close to the German line. And I was leading the men into the various sectors. I'd taken one lot in, and for a thing I had to get back quicker, I came over the top, and instead of going through the trenches. And the Germans put up a couple of Barry lights and spotted me, and a machine gun started spattering, and the next thing I knew, I'd got a bullet through my foot. I crawled back to the trenches and got hold of my petty officer of my platoon, and then I spoke to the company officer lying on my stretcher. I gave him all the various strong points and so on, and how the manning should be done and all the rest of it, which I'd taken over from this other battalion that was going out. And then I was evacuated back down the line on a very bumpy GS wagon until we could get to the point where the ambulances came up. And then I was taken down by ambulance to a hospital, I forget where it was, that one, Advanced number 2 Dressing Station, it was Advanced Hospital. And there my wound was dressed. They opened it up and bandaged me up, shoved me on a stretcher and stuck me on a hospital train going to the docks at Calais. Now this was not a hospital train like ours with proper bunks in. These were just, they rested the, they were really horse boxes, you know, things they carry horses in. And they just had racks in them, and they just stuck these stretchers across the racks, and these trains bump, 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 bump. Shocking, shocking journey. And then when they got down to Calais, I just got out, the German prisoners were used to get the stress stretchers out of the trains, out of the hospital trains, and a couple of German prisoners had just got hold of me and got me out onto the cold dock on an April morning. And they were given orders to dump us down because they were all searched for something they'd stolen. So somebody had said they'd had something stolen. And for about 20 minutes I lay on the blooming deck on the dock, as cold as until finally I was put on board the hospital ship, and a very nice nursing sister came and took pity on us and gave us a hot water bottle. But that was that. And then, of course, we went over to England, and when we got over here, the landing officers decided that we were not specialist officers and we must go to Manchester, and I went up to Manchester.
How often did you have leave?
Did you have leave? Well, of course, you didn't get leave from France. I didn't have any from France at all. But an ordinary, about 3 months, something like that. About 3 months.
Did you find that the civilians knew much about what was happening in France?
Yes. And there was a lot of, there was a lot of this white feather business, you know. I was rather amused. I was on one of my leaves in the early part of the war. I was spending a holiday with my mother down on the coast of Wales. Oh, the darn place escapes me.
This would have been in 1916.
I can't remember. No, it wasn't Aberystwyth. No, it was somewhere. Oh, I forget the name of the darn place. I was wearing an old civilian jacket and trousers because I was on leave, and some little girl came up and presented me with a white feather. that was quite common. That was quite a common thing. And but of course, people who had been in the forces and had been invalided out were given a special badge, a special silver badge, many of which they've still got. I never had one, of course, because I wasn't invalided out. They used to wear that on the lapel of their jackets in civil life again, so that they weren't ever embarrassed by people coming up. I mean, there were many of them were invalided out for various things. I mean, it'd be rheumatism or something, which you couldn't possibly see, you know, or it might be anything.
Did you hear people talking about the war, how it was going?
They talked about it, yes, but there, you know, there were all this security business, you know. And another thing, of course, they had in the pubs, which was the no-treating order, you know. You weren't allowed, I couldn't take you into a pub and buy you a drink if I'd wanted to. You'd have to pay for your own, and I'd have to pay for mine. And the only way I could give you a drink would be to slide the money to you so that you paid for yours and I paid for mine. This was the no-treating order, so that they tried to stop what we call the social life of a pub. They tried to stop it as much as possible because of the possibility of people saying, unguarded things, getting a bit over, having a drink or two over the odds and saying unguarded things. But there was a lot of security about like that. I mean, I'm not able to speak on it because I wouldn't have anything whatever to do with it. I only know what I've heard, but I can't. It's an awful long time ago, and but I never had anything whatever to do with it. There was a lot of, a lot of funny little orders like that thing about the no treating and those sort of things to try and stop people, you know. I think there wasn't the last war too. Of course, you were too young for that.
Did you ever hear anybody, either a civilian or soldiers, expressing criticism of the way the war was being run?
Of course they did. Lloyd George, yes. And the generals, good gracious, yes, of course they did. Of course they did. But, I mean, you got that any time. You got that in the other war just the same. Of course they talk about it. Of course they did. I mean, there wasn't everybody wasn't on the side of old Churchill in the last war by a long chalk. There used to be all sorts of things said, and certainly it was so with Lloyd George, because Lloyd George wanted to have his way, whereas the generals wanted to have theirs. And there was a tremendous clash between Haig and the top generals and Lloyd George. That's very well known, of course. Very well known.
Did you ever hear anybody, or did you ever think the Germans might win?
No. No, I don't think we ever thought that. I don't think so. I don't think we ever thought that. I don't think we thought that it was going to end quite when it did. But I was back in England by that time, and I wasn't out in France. I was back in England in April 1918. I didn't go out anymore. So it wasn't so easy to see what was happening on the front. After all, you weren't there. You weren't finding, you didn't see how the Germans were finally getting mown down. They were simply, their manpower couldn't stand it. It didn't come as a tremendous surprise. Actually, I was in hospital with tonsillitis when the armistice was signed, but it didn't come as a... I was training on this to be a pilot in the Air Force because I couldn't march anymore because of my foot. I don't remember the... I don't remember that. I think it came rather suddenly to some people. But we thought it had rather been engineered because, you see, it was the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. We always thought that was rather engineered, that they'd worked it that way, that this armistice, which was signed, of course, in this railway carriage at Compiègne, must have been engineered to fix it so very neatly. That time, the 11th hour, the 11th day, the 11th month, and that's how it was. And a couple of days after a couple of days before the armistice, they had a Lord Mayor's show. I think I'm right in saying it was Sir Horace Marshall who was being made Lord Mayor in the City of London, and I was in hospital at Northwood, and we were taken in coaches. Wounded officer. I wasn't wounded. I only had my tonsillitis, so I was a bit of a fraud. And we were, at the Lord Mayor's special request, we were placed in a window of a first floor office in Cornhill, so that we could see the whole of the Lord Mayor's show. And there were about a dozen or 15 of us officers. And so I saw this Victory Lord Mayor's show. And they knew then that the armistice, because it was called the Victory Lord Mayor's show, they knew then that the war was ending, and in point of fact, that was on the Saturday, I think I'm right in saying, and on the Monday the armistice was signed, and the whole thing stopped. And then, of course, hell broke loose. I got a pass out. I was getting better off this tonsillitis, and of course I wasn't a cripple or anything, And I got a pass out of this hospital, Mount Vernon, I think it was at the hospital, and got into town. Oh, and I remember I was three parts tight. I'd got somebody's bowler hat on with the lid coming up, and somebody kept putting cabbage leaves and things through this lid thing onto my head. And I was standing on the table singing at the top of my voice, and suddenly a voice came down, "Get down from there!" It was my commanding officer. That was the armistice. Oh, yes, I had a wonderful time at the armistice. And I had to stay in the Air Force for right until January, because they didn't know what to do with us. You see, we were part trained. I'd done all the ground training, and I was due to go to fly at North Holt the week the war ended. So, of course, they didn't send us. Naturally, they didn't want any more pilots. We got too many already. And so they kept us fooling around at this. I think we were at Uxbridge by that time, or Ealing. Ealing it might have been. We were in old Bath at Ealing, I think. And we were doing the Maxim gun. And it was very convenient. We used to stand round in a circle, about 8 or 10 of us, and we had a corporal instructor, and this thing used to swivel round on its spindle thing, you know, legs thing, and we used to stand round, and we all bet so-and-so, do you see, and we'd get the corporal to spin, put a shilling on each, and whoever stopped off us, he got the money.
Yes.
Or sixpence or something. I know we had to pay so much each, and occasionally you'd win one, you see, the thing would spin round. Just as it would stop, you know, sort of roulette sort of thing, you know. And we did that, and then there came out an order in, I suppose it would be at the end of November, I suppose it might have been, or early December, saying that any officers or men who could prove that they were required by their civilian employers, and if their civilian employers would make application, they could be given prior release. And the banks were particularly mentioned, and so I wrote to the manager of the bank that I was in Longton, in the Potteries, and asked him if he'd like to make application, sent him the right form and so on, for me to be released. And I was released on indefinite leave in January 1919 to go back to work in the bank. But of course I wasn't compelled. I was being paid as an officer. Bing Bevel was so well paid me life, I don't think. I was paid as an officer and also paid by the bank. But of course I didn't have to wear uniform in the office, and I never did. I was just a clerk in the bank. And then I wasn't demobilised till the following July. They were so frightfully slow.
You were recalled.
I was recalled, yes. In June, because to Uxbridge by that time, because they'd got so, I think it was about 15 officers under arrest, under close arrest. And every officer under close arrest, you can't put him in a guard room and put a sentry over the door. You have to give him an officer of equal rank who stays with him all the time. And they found it rather a drain on these officers, and so somebody had the bright idea of calling us back, who'd been given this indefinite leave, because we were still in the Army, or Air Force rather. And so we were sent for. I got a telegram calling me back. And I had to report, much to the annoyance of my bank manager, as it happened about a fortnight before the half-yearly balance. So he was very pleased. And I went back there, and we used to do 24 hours on duty with one of these officers, and it was a rotten job. You had to stay in their quarters, and you had to be very careful they didn't escape. One or two of them were prone to escape. And then you had 2 days off. You did one day on, 2 days off. This went on for about a month. And then I was sent up to Alnwick. I had to be demobbed by the Royal Naval Division, you see, because I was only on posting to the RAF for training, you see. I wasn't in the RAF. I was still wearing Royal Naval Division uniform, you see. I was only for training. But they called on us for work for them, you see. And then they sent me up to Alnwick, right up to Northumberland, to get demobbed around. All ridiculous things. Travel all the way up there, all the way back again. Absolute waste of money.
What sort of crimes had these officers committed? What sort of crimes had these officers committed?
Oh, there are all sorts of things. I can't remember details of them. One man had stabbed a girl in the neck. He was half French. He was an extraordinary fellow. Pierre, something or other, he'd escaped twice. He was really dangerous. He was really dangerous because he was allowed to escape. He was half French and he'd stabbed a girl in a pub. And I don't know why the civilian population, and the civilian police hadn't got hold of him. It may not have been in a pub, it may have been in the Naffy or something, I forget now. We didn't have Naffy in those days. But he'd stabbed a girl, I know. I don't know where it was he'd done it. And there was another fella who'd broken out of hospital. Well, that was a crime. He was a very nice fella named Sullivan. He was a very nice chap. Oh, I had several of them. I forget what they'd all done. They'd all done different things.
Did you think, in the 1920s, looking back on the First World War, that all the hardships and experience and sacrifices had been worthwhile?
Well, I can only say one thing. I wouldn't have missed it. I wouldn't have missed it. It was terrible at times, but I think everyone, after all, I suppose perhaps some of the conscripts didn't like it much, but most of us were volunteers, you know, a great deal, many of us were. I personally was a volunteer, as direct enlistment. I'd possibly have been called up later on if I hadn't gone, but I wouldn't have missed it. I wouldn't have missed the next war either. I couldn't do as much in the next one as I did in the first because I was too old, but at the same time I wouldn't have missed it. I wouldn't have wanted to skulk back and be a firefighter or an ambulance driver or something of that kind, although I dare say I'd have had a worse time than I did. But I am one of these people, and there are a few about, who seem to bear a charmed life. I don't know why. I can't tell you. I went out to the Middle East in this last war in 1943, I think it was, and the convoy before the one that I went on, the Germans had flown off from Sicily and had sunk two ships, and the one that followed, they sank three ships. The one I went out on, no convoy, nothing. I can't tell you. I've had some extraordinary experiences like that. I was posted in this last war to Tipton in Staffordshire as a Home Guard officer. That's to say, I was a quartermaster. I was a serving officer to administer the Home Guard battalion at Tipton. They bombed Birmingham and they bombed Tipton. They bombed West Bromwich. They bombed the whole of that area a month before I went there. I was there for, I think, 9 months. Or something like that. They never dropped a bomb while I was there. The week after I left, they bombed it again. Of course, that's ridiculous. It's quite ridiculous. I'm sure you've had quite enough now.